Welcome on, third episode already. We are old hands at this now. Nate Duncan here, joined by John Hollinger. If you're a new listener, don't forget to subscribe. Just search Hollinger and Duncan. You probably even could get away with just searching Hollinger in your podcast player of choice. Mash that subscribe button. Give us a review. Tell your friends. Share on Twitter or your social media platform of choice. Anything you can do there to help us get this thing off the ground and convince the incredible luminary John Hollinger to continue doing this podcast with little old me.
You did not call me podcast veteran John Hollinger.
I'm saving that for episode 4. All right, well, let's talk a little basketball here instead of discussing our boring lives. You wrote a piece this week on the Toronto Raptors. You're up there for Ring Night. We talked about that a little bit last week, but their team, especially getting off to this pretty decent start now, some good growth from their young players. And the idea of just where they go from here is a fascinating one. I think the place I want to start with that, though, is, and I think this is always important when we go through this of trying to figure out what a team's path should be, is just what do they have right now? And I think where I want to start is what you've seen from Pascal Siakam before. I mean, to my eyes, he's taken another pretty big leap forward here. If you're looking at him as a foundational piece, you know, how good is that as, you know, potentially your number one option on a team going forward?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I wrote about in the Athletic is just sizing up where this team is right now and where they're going. And Siakam's definitely a piece of that that's still a developing story because he gets better almost seemingly with each game and develops new skills. So, you know, I think last year people thought of him as a number two, number three guy. Now you look at him as he's clearly the number one guy on the Raptors right now, who are clearly a pretty good team right now. But where's the limit? Where does this go? Can he be the number one guy on a championship team? Does he have to be the number two guy on a team like that? I think those are important questions for the Raptors to get answers to, because that does dictate some choices for them.
You know, it was only this time last year that I was castigating him for dribbling too much and like, oh, come on. Like, it's nice that you think you have this skill level, but like, how far is it really going to go? And obviously I proved to be a complete moron in that regard, and he's looked fantastic so far. I think the development of the jumper to me is the biggest thing for him, as far as someone that you can put the ball in his hands all the time, because you've saw teams have a lot of success putting bigger guys on him in the playoffs, and he wasn't able to force them to guard him out on the floor so he could blow by or make him pay with the jumper. And so then he was going into length trying to finish it. That wasn't really going to work that well. Now, the way he's hit the jump shot, had a rough one against the Bucks last night, but overall, the way he shot it, especially off the dribble from 3-2-point range, he shot it well. And so now, if you can't put the center on him anymore, now you really have a pretty limited number of guys in the league who can guard him. And you know, maybe you can count 10 of them where you're not going to have to feel like we got to bring help on every possession. And that's exceedingly valuable.
Absolutely. Yeah, like you said, even in the postseason last year, teams were okay living with him shooting from outside. And if that gets to be a choice teams don't want to make, then you run out of guys who can guard him pretty quickly, or you end up in a situation where you still have to give up the jump shot because it's the least bad thing you can give up, but they're going in at a high enough clip that it's great offense for the Raptors.
Yeah, and he's shooting 42% from three on 5.5 per game right now. Not going to stay that high, I'm going to guess. But even if it's 36% and you consider a lot of those are off the dribble, that's going to be pretty darn difficult to deal with. So I think, you know, I don't know if he's going to be a top 10 player in the league, but when you consider his defense, you could see him maybe being top 20. But beyond there, they got a nice piece in Anunoby, and then it's mostly veteran role players with this group, and they are relatively thin, having lost two rotation pieces that they really didn't replace at all with limited resources to do so, admittedly, and also having to wait for 6 days for Kawhi to make his decision. So if you're looking at the Raptors right now, and this gets to some existential questions for me that I always think are interesting, you know, how much is it worth to be the fourth seed this year and probably lose in five or six games in the second round to Philly or something like that, versus the possibility of maybe trading Kyle Lowry and Marc Gasol or Serge Ibaka, and potentially trying to reload for 2021 when they might try and get Giannis. And then there's also the idea of Kyle Lowry as this franchise icon, and do you want to move him? How do you think they're trying to balance all of those factors?
Well, I think in some ways, Masai Ujiri's history speaks for itself, right? That he's not a guy who's content to just be pretty good for several years. We saw that already. You don't do the DeRozan trade if that's your mindset. And as this team goes forward, I think the other thing is the development of Siakam is now he's that magnet guy that another star could glom onto and say, okay, if I team up with this guy, we're going to be really good. And so that adds another layer to it once you get into free agency type situations. Toronto, too, is in a situation where, I mean, because they play in the East, they can probably have their cake and eat it, too. They'll make the – if they trade these guys in February, they'll probably still make the playoffs. They'll probably have banked up enough wins by then, and there's enough mediocre teams they can get some more. You know, they can limp in with 43 or 44 or whatever and kind of play it both ways.
Yeah, well, the East does not look good to start the year for sure, and Toronto is looking like a playoff lock. To me, though, it's a sliding scale on just what can you get for these guys, right? And some years we've seen teams really going for it. We'll see, you know, an Aaron Aflalo or a Jeff Green get traded for a first-round pick. Then it yo-yoed the opposite direction, in part because first-round picks became undervalued on the rookie salary scale. Now the rookie salary scale is going up again a little bit. So just the question of who really can use these guys and what the price is, right? I mean, if it's, hey, we'll trade you a first-round pick, lottery-protected, for Kyle Lowry for the end of this year and next year, I mean, to me, even if it, you know, Kyle Lowry isn't necessarily going to win you a playoff series, that's not worth it for me, especially considering what he's meant to the franchise. I mean, I think it's got to get closer to something like the package for Mike Conley being sent to Utah, where you really start to think about it. You know, and Gasol, Ibaka, I mean, maybe if there's an understanding that those guys don't want to come back and you could get a lottery protected first for one of those guys, then maybe you do it. But do you think that there is an enticing enough package out there for these guys to make it worth it to make yourself worse this season? And in the case of Lowry, to really perhaps alienate the fan base and take away what's obviously a great story for Mr. Toronto Raptor?
I think they've already shown they're willing to face the music on stuff like that. Obviously they did this to get to Kawhi Leonard last time, but they've been open for business on other players though. So,
yeah, but I mean, are you doing it for just a lotto protected first round pick? I mean, that to me, I wouldn't do it, in part because the player is still good and you still win games. Like, that still has value too.
I think, one of the things when we talk about just about a draft pick, you're trying to be as enticing as you can in the summer of 2021. So it's not necessarily about the draft pick you get back, but can you gain 7 years on a trade, right? Can you get somebody who's in their 20s who maybe isn't as good as Kyle Lowry right now, but can be part of that group going forward where you say Siakam and a re-signed Van Vliet maybe and this other guy, and now you're talking about a really good nucleus to put around a potential free agent. I don't know, maybe if you sign somebody from Greece, for instance.
You reported in your piece, according to league sources, that they will be going after Giannis in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure that out, but you know, half the league will be doing the same thing. But I do think Toronto sees themselves as being a prime contender for him and really having a legitimate shot in a way that several other teams probably do not.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Of course, he destroyed them last night, ironically, as we're talking about this. The fit of him and Siakam is an interesting one, too. And would you play Siakam at the 3 and Giannis at the 4? And then you basically would have to have a stretch 5, or you would close games with Giannis at the 5 and Siakam at the 4. I mean, those two players are extremely similar to one another. I actually called Siakam sort of a poor man's Giannis before he learned to shoot. So that, I mean, obviously it's one of those problems that you figure out, and it would be great. I don't think Giannis is going to like not come there because Siakam is already there and they have somewhat similar skill sets. But that would be fascinating to think about those two guys on the same team.
I mean, when you get to like fourth quarters and playoff games and you can play those two at 4 and 5 and put three smalls around them, that's going to be really hard to deal with to me.
Yeah, I'm not going to say I hope it happens because I enjoy watching Giannis now. So, I guess back to the initial question, though. I mean, what do you think the price realistically is for Lowry? Not that would make them jump, but that would realistically be available from another team.
Right. You raise an interesting dilemma. Is someone going to go beyond a protected first for him? Unlikely, but maybe there's some combination of assets where the pick isn't great, but you get a player back too who's interesting. As I look at their situation, I do think the player side is probably more interesting than the pick side, unless you're talking about a pick that they can definitely get this year, and that there was someone that they liked that they knew they kind of wanted this year, because.
Let me stop you there. So you think even as early as the trade deadline, if you're saying, hey, we're going to get a lot of protected pick, this pick is going to be probably, you know, our analytics department projects that this team, if they get Kyle Lowry, they're going to give us the 22nd pick. You go as far as to say, no, it's not just the value of the 22nd pick. It's, hey, we think there's someone who's going to be there at 22 that we really want. You're looking that far forward as far as specific players who might be available at that number.
Probably a little bit of a reach as I think about this to be saying that in February. Although I will say, I mean, they were on Bruno really early that year, and I think he was going to be their guy from a pretty early point. Now I don't know if it was quite that early. You raise a good point. When you're at the trade deadline, you're looking more at what will the suite of options be. Let's say who are the guys we're likely looking at. I mean, even then you sort of have an idea. One of the things we talked about a lot in valuing draft picks was just how good is this draft this year? Are there a wide variety of players we like, or is it pretty limited? And there's definitely been years with each.
Did you guys turn out to be right on that? Like I've always felt like good draft, bad draft. People say that. And then you look back 3 years, 4 years later, and it never actually seems to correlate with what people were saying before the draft.
I would say there's been some correlation, but you're correct. There's a tendency among the group to, at this time of year, when you're first seeing prospects, to say, wow, this year's draft isn't very good. And then as the year goes on, you start seeing more people and like a few more by draft night, you're excited about 61 players. So there's definitely a tendency toward that, but I do think there's a knowledge, especially well, in two areas. One, at the high end, who are the, you know, true elite. You know, if there's an Anthony Davis in the draft, you know pretty quickly. Yeah. And then I do think the depth into the first round and the back end of the lottery is something that we've been able to do an okay job of forecasting, kind of knowing which years had closer to 15 to 20 really high level guys, and which years had probably closer to 8 to 10. Now it doesn't mean we were all right about who belonged in which group, but generally, if you looked at the size of the buckets, you get a pretty good idea of the quality of the draft, especially when we're talking about a first round pick.
Yeah, I over the years have focused more on the top 10, and I remember, you know, 2014 was supposed to be the seminal draft. You look back now, other than Embiid, there really isn't anyone in that top 10 that's been a big star. 2015 was not supposed to be that great going, you know, a year out, and then it was awesome, you know, 2 months afterwards, and now you look back and it's kind of okay. 2016, everyone was right about that one, hasn't been any good. 2018, I don't remember anyone being like, oh, this is amazing, but look back, that one's pretty good. 2019, people were down on it. It's looking okay so far. So it's, I think it is kind of difficult to do it. But from my standpoint, I kind of look at it as just like, okay, the value of the pick is just what's the typical value of the pick. Now, obviously, I don't do as much scouting as you do for the guys later. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to talk about. So, yeah, I mean, we tried to answer this three times, but we kind of gotten sidetracked thanks to me. Yeah, I really wonder who it would be that's going to give up more than just, you know, your kind of decent prospect who's in his second year or your lotto protected first round pick for Lowry. Yeah, I mean, maybe a team like the Clippers, you could look at that. Lowry would be an unbelievable fit there.
It gets interesting if we start seeing an arms race Every contender could use Lowry. Even if you have a point guard, you just play Lowry next to him. He's so tough. He can guard every two in the league, basically. He's a winning player. Come playoff time, he's going to do all those little things. Doesn't need to be the guy, as he showed last year. So I think he contributes on a lot of different levels. In terms of what a package could look like to entice them more, here's an interesting question. Is Norm Powell a positive or negative asset at his number?
Looking like probably negative at this point. He's not off to the greatest start this year. I mean, he's going to play. Also, once Siakam fouled out, they decided in the first game that he was their best isolation player. But aside from that, I mean, I think you probably got to say negative, especially given how far out that contract runs.
Well, exactly. So then can you make it a more enticing package by coming back to Toronto and saying, we'll remove this 11 from your book and then make your life easier in free agency in 21, where to the point that you might be able to pay a bigger number than you hope for Van Vliet or keep one of these other secondary guys on your books and still be able to have max room? Is there value in that?
Yeah, then you get into some salary matching trouble too. Then you got, you know, $40 million worth of salary that you got to match. That could be difficult for some of these teams, especially teams that just put together their team. You know, Lakers, Clippers, Sixers. You know, those are all teams that could probably really use Lowry, but in terms of A, the assets coming back with the Lakers, and B, the matching salary, I think a lot of those teams would be kind of hard-pressed to find enough. Clippers might have the best chance, but unless you're trading Tobias Harris as your Philly, you know, that then it's tough there too.
Philly definitely has a hard time getting to large salary match numbers. You know, they can either pool like eight guys together or they can trade one of their starters. And yeah, I'm not sure either of those is realistic.
All right, let's take a quick break here, and we need to talk a little bit more about the Orlando Magic, a team that John saw twice, and another fascinating team-building exercise there for them, given where they are as a lower-run playoff team, but maybe not any clear paths for improving. So we'll talk to that right after this. All right, you spent the last 2 days in Orlando. Let's start off same question that we had with Toronto. How are they looking right now?
Well, it's a little rough on the offensive end, I'll say. They are last in offensive efficiency. They are last in three-point shooting. They are last in shooting at the rim, I believe, as well. And
last in free throw rate.
So there's a lot of things that are not going well for them offensively. They did move Markelle Fultz into the starting lineup for DJ Augustine for the game against Denver. And the interesting part of that to me was not that Augustine was doing horribly with the starters, although he's not exactly setting the world on fire either, but that when they would bring in Fultz with a second unit that already had Aminu and Bamba, and a lot of times Evan Fournier was off the floor by then, you just ran into these catastrophic spacing scenarios. And you really saw it against Milwaukee's length the night before, where the starters got Orlando out to a nice lead. And then once they got into the bench, Milwaukee went on a 40-9 run to turn a 13-point deficit into a giant blowout by halftime. So it's going to be interesting. I mean, Fultz, you see little baby steps each game, but right now he's still a negative offensive player with the way he's shooting the ball and how far people play off of him. But he's 21 years old. I still think there's a lot of hope in that organization that he can continue to take steps forward and be a long-term starter for them.
Yeah, some of these shooting numbers for them are ghastly right now. Vucevic, 21% from three. Augustine, you might say, well, hey, how can you take him off the floor? Their problem is they can't shoot. Well, he's only taken 12 threes in six games and made three of them. So, I mean, he was a big part of what they're doing last year because he could actually take that shot off the pick and roll. Now, you know, for whatever reason, you've probably watched him more than I have, but hasn't been able to get his shot off from three.
I can't remember him taking. I've seen them in person four times this year. I can't remember him taking 1-3 off the dribble. Maybe he did, and I just didn't record it. But it's not a frequent event.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to shoot it better overall, I think. But the problem is, they're so bad in offense right now that, like, even if they just get back to kind of passable level shooting the ball, they're still going to be, like, really behind the eight ball offensively. And they're, you know, even in their playoff season a year ago, they were 22nd in offense. And, you know, the defense has been fine. I think they can, that can maintain all year. But yeah, I mean, it's hard for me to see them getting out of the 20s in offense. And some of their young players have kind of stagnated a little bit. You know, there isn't really anyone that you look at faults with his shooting limitations. Isaac hasn't shot it well. Aaron Gordon, a rough start to the year. You know, those were kind of their three hopes for getting a lot better. One of those guys would pop, they take the next step. So what the hell do they do as an organization now? I mean, last year was a great story. They'd been out of the playoffs for seven straight years after the Dwight Howard trade before that, but they're kind of in NBA purgatory now. How do they get out?
Yeah, I think step one for them is don't panic, because they still they still have a wind at their backs in terms of the ages of a lot of these guys. Their cap situation is pretty good. Even the players that they have that are more veterans, like Vucevic and Gordon, have declining money on their contracts. Fournier's contract probably isn't great, but it's not killing them either. Like, they're in a pretty good situation to go in a lot of different directions, or to strike when somebody becomes available that maybe you wouldn't expect to be available. They still have all their picks. They have younger players in the pipeline. You know, you talk about Isaac, they'd probably be reluctant to put in a deal or whatever, but they have these guys like Fultz and Mo Bamba, you know, when Aaron Gordon, maybe Chuma Okeke, who's probably not going to play this year, but showed some real offensive talent at Auburn a year ago and could be a guy who helps unlock them a little bit. I do think eventually they're going to have to choose at the 3, 4, 5, which of these guys are going to go forward with and which of them is expendable in a trade for another guard. Because they're going to need another guard and another shooter at some point here. Steve Clifford would say that point is probably tomorrow, but they're going to need that just to be able to play a real NBA offense. And then I think to kind of even out this jumble, this bulge they have at the 3-4, where you have Gordon, Isaac, Al-Farouq Aminu, and then you still have Okeke, who's a combo forward coming in next year. That has to get settled out at some point, especially if Okeke can play, which obviously they're hoping he can, and I do believe he can. I think he's a pretty good offensive player. So that probably is the biggest thing they have to weigh. And again, they don't have to do it immediately, but there has to be an evaluation of which of these guys is really core and which of them is expendable, and how do we turn those that expendable piece or pieces into the thing we need.
So what do you think? Who's core, who's expendable?
I think Isaac, to me, is the most core, just because he has the ceiling to be a one-man defense almost, where just having him on your team, like a Rudy Gobert, where just having him on your team guarantees that you're top 5 or top 10 or whatever defensively.
Yeah. He just looks huge out there, man. Like, he is enormous.
Yeah, there are plays he just swallowed up. And you could see in the Denver game, just scenarios where Paul Millsap ISOs against him, and you realize two dribbles into it that this is just hopeless. Like, it's not going to happen at all. And and you saw it even in the Milwaukee game where he was, you know, able to make some stands against Giannis. That he's only 22. He's a youngish 22 too, in terms of he didn't come in all chiseled and filled out and everything too. Yeah. And his offensive game still has places that he needs to get to, but defensively, man, he's really good right now and can still get a lot better.
It's really difficult for me to figure out where the guy, I agree with you. Isaac is probably the guy I like the most. And yeah, I mean, they're, you know, Terrence Ross is also shooting 19% from three right now. Like, they're going to get better. As far as making the playoffs this year, I think they're still going to do it. I agree. Don't panic. But in terms of the long-term franchise, you noted that some of their guys are younger. I would point out that their two best players last year were Vucevic and Augustin, and both of those guys were big regression candidates this year for me, and that's been occurring so far. Absolutely. Again, both those guys will shoot better, but, you know, and they kind of doubled down, bring back Ross as well on, you know, a market level contract. So I just, they're not going to have space for a while. They haven't been a free agent destination the way they were back in the 90s. So I really, I'm at a loss to determine where they go from here. I mean, it seems like maybe you just hold on to everyone this year and hope that you can kind of make the playoffs, and maybe that's enough in that market. And so then the question becomes, you know, are you happy being a six seed at best? You know, kind of being, they're kind of in like, you know, Detroit Pistons style purgatory for these last 4 years. Is that better than rebuilding? They just came from rebuilding, but yeah, they weren't able to really build anything that was that high a ceiling. I mean, I would be trying to move basically anyone, I think, and just taking my medicine and trying to really go back, keep Isaac, keep Fultz, and maybe anyone else to me is on the table. And if you get worse ultimately, so be it. Because to me, being the seventh seed year after year is pretty meaningless, but that's not the reality in every market.
I think if based on what happened the last 7 years, being the seventh seed sounds phenomenal to them right now. But
that gets stale so
at
fast,
some point though, it gets, yeah, it gets stale quickly, especially if you're getting there by winning 83-78. So they are going to have to make some choice. I think they bought themselves a year of equity, right? But they're going to have to make some choices. And inevitably it comes down to is where is the star coming from? Who's on this team that can be the best player on a 50 win team?
Yeah. And my answer would be, you know, your number one draft pick in 2021 after you traded everyone. But, you know, it's kind of, and yeah, I get it that kind of sucks, especially because you're now relevant. But I said it about Charlotte when they didn't trade Kemba Walker. It's like, okay, yeah, you know, you could be around the eighth seed. You might get in some years. You might not get in some years. But the rebuild is going to have to come eventually anyway. And so you might as well do it on your terms rather than guys just leaving in free agency, or you have a couple of years where guys just get injured and you're not any good and you didn't get anything for these guys when you could have. And then you're going to have a forced rebuild, whether you want to do it or not, 3 years from now, after you've been in purgatory for these 3 years. Why not just do it ahead of time? I realize this is kind of a trope, like, oh, just do, every team should just do the process and do cap space and tank and try and get draft picks. But for this team in particular, I really just, you can't even squint at them and see where the finish line is as far as being, you know, a 50 win type of team perennially.
I think that finish line is a little bit more in view. I think you're counting on Isaac becoming a monster. I think you're counting on,
like,
counting
on offense though.
No. The offense has to come by making a trade. And that's going to be the hardest part. They're going to have to at some point, and they may have to put assets into that. And they've done a good job preserving their assets, right? But at some point, they may have to push those chips in and say, okay, you know what? We'll take, you know, some of these guys who are $15, $17 million contracts or whatever, lump them together, throw in a first round pick or two and bring in somebody to be the guy.
If there's any hope for Bamba, it looks, from my standpoint, it looks like they just totally missed on him.
Well, let me tell you, last night was a rough outing for the Bamba stands. look confused when he was out there, picked up fouls quickly. The lower body strength, I think, is an issue. Looks like they held him out for rest the night before. So you worry about the lower extremities again, which is the reason he was out at the end of last year.
Yeah, and also the reason they made the playoffs last year, by the way.
Well, yeah, Ken Birch came in and gave them much more competent play from the center position. It wasn't the only reason, obviously. They were also miraculously healthy in their top six for the entire year. But it was definitely a turning point, without a doubt. Bamba is still really raw. He has some skill to him in terms of shooting ability for a guy of his size. And obviously his length is something that you hope can eventually be a massive factor on the defensive end, but it hasn't translated yet. And they knew they were getting a little bit of a project, that he wasn't going to come in and be Luka right away and run the whole team. But I think it's taking longer than they hoped.
I think if you're going to maybe try to reshuffle the deck with these guys a little bit, I might look at someone like Spencer Dinwiddie, who's still pretty young, under contract for another year after this one. They would have full bird rights on him after that. You know, maybe you could move Aaron Gordon for him, right? And you might say Gordon plays a more valuable position, but as you mentioned, he's also the same position basically as Isaac. They don't have enough shooting when they play those guys together. The Nets, Dinwiddie might be superfluous. If you're going to hold on to LeVert, you're going to have KD and Irving. You know, maybe you don't need him. You need to get more athletic, get some better defense in the front court. So that might be the type of trade that I would look at. And Dinwiddie is young enough where, hey, maybe if you give him the keys every game, and pair him with a center like Vucevic, who's so skilled, that maybe he could pop and get to be like close to a lower level all-star point guard. And that's how you take another step forward. That's the sort of trade maybe in the short term I might be looking at. And then if that doesn't work, you say, we're going to really blow it up.
You know what's so funny is I was talking to somebody this weekend who does not work for the Magic, but is somebody who I respect on Basketball Matters, who mentioned that Spencer Dinwiddie would be a good trade target for somebody because he might be a lot better outside of Brooklyn without Kyrie there and whatnot. So it's funny you bring him up too, but that's the type of thing I think they need to think about where, so there's two levels of how they can do this, right? There's a one where they just, you know, the Paul George trade, just here's all our assets. Give us that, you know, top 10 player in the league. Obviously, I think that's something they have to look at, but failing that, they have to kind of cultivate a guy in their own who could maybe be their Lowry, so to speak, where a guy came in and wasn't really seen as a star, but evolved into one for that team.
Yeah.
Which is what, I mean, that's what we had in Memphis with Zach Randolph and Tony Allen, where they were, you know, Tony Allen was a below mid-level free agent. Zach Randolph was a guy who came in a trade for a basically dead money contract. And so you're looking at how maybe can you body snatch like that in Orlando?
All right. After that depressing look at the Magic, perhaps, I don't know, maybe it's not depressing. There's probably a lot of teams that would love to have their problems, but let's take a quick break, and then we got to do some mailbag and Holland Journey still coming up here as well. All right, let's start here with McGee Patrick. Good question here. Another long-term team-building question. I really enjoy talking about these ones with you. What is the Mavericks' best and or most likely path towards a third piece, and do they need one?
Well, I think we know what their best path is. It's 2021 free agency, and the reason for that is because that's right before Luka Doncic's presumable max extension would kick in. So that would be the last year they'd probably have significant cap room with this group just set up the way they are, with Luka almost certainly being on a max deal and Porzingis being on max already. And
yeah, $35 million in space is my projection for them.
And they're in position to, they have enough role players on seemingly movable deals. They can get to whatever number they need to get to that summer if there's somebody who's worth that money. But free agency is almost certainly their pathway given the draft capital they've already given up. I don't think they're going to be able to make another deal like the Porzingis deal where they put in multiple picks or whatever. They just don't have the capital to do that. And I think people look at them now too as like, well, your pick's going to be 23rd, so why would I make that trade?
They're out 2021 and 2023 picks from that trade with the Knicks.
The equally interesting question, I think, is do you even want to go that way? Do you make yourself too top heavy on your roster when you have the 3 max model versus having 2 max guys and the flexibility to have a bunch of DeLon Wrights and Max Klebas around them? Is that a better model, or is it potentially a better model for this team?
Yeah. I mean, if your third guy is Tobias Harris, no, I don't think so. If your third guy is Paul George or something, then yeah, I think you do get that and you figure out later, especially because then if you're that good, you can start to bring in some of those players, you know, Wes Matthews styles on veterans minimums. But
don't bring nuance into this, Nate. We want absolutes.
Oh, man. But I mean, they obviously have been burned many a time with their cap space aspirations, including this last summer. I think they probably thought they could be a little bit more of a draw for, say, a Kemba Walker than they ended up being. But we'll see. You know, I mean, if they're, you know, the five seed the next couple of years, which isn't out of the realm of possibility, they've looked pretty good so far here, then they become a lot more attractive there. And I mean, they still, like you said, they have Wright at 8 million, Kleba's 8 million, Seth Curry, 8 million, Finney Smith, 4 million. So that's pretty decent depth still. Dwight Powell, who I think is overpaid, but they seem to love there. That's pretty decent depth still around that third star. And I don't, you get to the point too, is a point that you've made a lot where, hey, if you have a bunch of average guys, it's tough to upgrade by bringing in more average guys, right? You might as well go for the big star there and try to consolidate a little bit. But it's hard for me to see where it comes from other than that 2021 free agency. I agree with you there.
And then if they do it that way and get that big free agent in 21, there's also that comes with that an almost certain commitment to being a tax team for 2 or 3 years after that, because Luka's going to pop from 10 million to whatever his max is, and there may be a Rose rule on top of that. So he's going to be getting in the 30s.
How good do you think Porzingis is? How's he looking to you so far this year? Is he like, you know, dead bang number two guy on a really good team to you now at this point, assuming he stays healthy?
I think the threat of Porzingis has been as effective as the actual Porzingis, right? In terms of guys hugging up on him and leaving lanes for the other guards. You see DeLon Wright and Jalen Brunson have a lot of room to operate just when he's out there with them. People don't want to leave him. We also saw him, I think, really struggle sometimes in post-up, like the New Orleans games. They put Drew Holiday on him and Porzingis couldn't move him and couldn't get any kind of shot against him. And I don't want to jump here though. Like, we should expect that. He's still getting his timing back. He didn't play at all last year. We should expect him to be a little rusty and not totally in sync, but man, that deep shooting ability at his size coupled with Luka's ability to pass is a really difficult combination. And I do wonder if we're going to see teams switch more against them, just because there's a fear factor in doing it because Porzingis is so tall, he can just shoot right over the top of it. And so maybe teams will abandon it because of that. But I just wonder if that's better than Luka getting you in rotation and you're scrambling and he's just able to pick out shooters left and right.
Yeah. Well, maybe your poison there, though, is Luka beating up your big in an ISO. That I think that's the bigger poison. Porzingis, yeah, I'm fine. Throw it to him. He wants to shoot a contested turnaround mid-ranger because he's not strong enough to back down. Like, you know, be my guest on that one. But I think Luka is the bigger concern there.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
You don't know if you buy him as an ISO guy?
Like him playing one-on-one against my big, if I have a good switching big, I feel pretty good about that. I feel like he's going to end up taking that step back. And you kind of live with that.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things. Like, it looks really awesome when he gets it going. It seems unstoppable. But then, you know, you look down, he shot 32% last year. You know, that's not, you can live with that number, you know, as compared to James Harden shooting 37% on those shots. You know, that's a big difference. So
I do think there's a little more of a concerted effort to push him right, too, and take that away.
You're talking about
Luka.
Luka, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I still like him going right as well. And then if he gets downhill with the right, you got to bring help. He can throw that right.
Yeah, he's going to throw darts corner with his right hand. That's the problem to me with forcing him right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That in his left hand, he doesn't quite have that same ability to pick guys out. But he's really comfortable, and he takes a giant step on his step back. It's really hard to get to that shot.
All right, next question here. In light of the Portland Mavs ending, for people who missed it, Terry Stotts challenged a foul on Dame Lillard right at the end, and it got overturned. They got a jump ball, and Dallas never really got a chance to tie after that. It was with about 10 seconds left. In light of that, how do you feel about the coach's challenge thus far? And let's just open it up here. We can talk about any aspect of the coach's challenge that's interested you so far.
Yeah, the strategy of the challenge has been interesting because some guys are using them right away. Some guys are really hanging on to them, making sure that they can have it for the high leverage moments, even if they don't need it. In the last 2 minutes, a lot of plays get reviewed anyway, so you can argue the value of the challenge diminishes significantly when you get under 2 minutes. Although in this case, Stotts used it almost on the final play of the game. It's a thing they're still learning how to use. It's funny because I've seen a lot of G League games and they have it in the G League, but it got used a lot in the G League on block charge, which I think at the NBA level is probably going to be used less because there's just better officials. Like you'd see in the G League, like it was like, wow, that was really wrong. And it would get challenged. I think you see that less at the NBA level. And then the other thing is, with the three-shot foul being so valuable, you almost don't want to use it unless there's a three-shot foul, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you're playing Houston. You know there's going to be one dubious one in there somewhere.
Well, so I talked to someone over the summer. This is I haven't seen any stats yet on the challenges so far in the NBA, but this is someone who worked for the league, had access to the G League and then the challenges that were implemented in summer league. And so these are some of the things that he said about just the overall success rates.
Okay.
Out of bounds calls, when you challenge that, you get about a 50-50 success rate. Challenges to fouls late in the game were the most likely to be unsuccessful. Now there's selection bias there too, right? I think you get called for a foul late in the game, even if you don't think it's necessarily a bad call.
You haven't used your challenge yet, so you might as well. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Although there is the negative of, well, now you're forced to take a timeout to do the challenge. You only get two timeouts at the end, so you may not want to use your timeout at the end.
So the real genius move then is to challenge a foul at 3:05, right? before you lose that third timeout.
Yeah, no, I think that's something. And Steve Kerr talked about that too. He said, you know, when it's your timeout coming up anyway, if you have a mandatory, that's a good time to challenge because it doesn't really. That timeout's about to get charged to you anyway, so you might as well just take it. And then the other thing was, this person I talked to said that foul calls that were challenged early in the game had the best success rate, because you're not going to challenge unless it's obvious.
Yeah.
And whether that's your star player getting his third foul in the first half or the three-shot foul. I mean, I think if you have a three-shot foul that you got called for and you are pretty darn sure that was a bad call. I mean, I think that one's a no-brainer. I think you just use it then.
Well, especially if it's a leg kick three-shot foul where you can also put an offensive foul on another player.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's an underrated aspect too, is that if you have a shooting foul that's challenged and they just overturn it to a non-call, then it's a jump ball. So also you might want to save those for, you know, when there's two on the shot clock and you get called for a bad foul. Because then at least the other team is probably not going to score, right? If they got 14 on the shot clock still and they have the person who's going to win the jump ball, then yeah, I mean, maybe you took 2 points off the board, but they still get a possession.
I thought you were going to go a different direction with that. I thought you were going to say, wait till you have somebody like Boban in the game where you know you'll win the jump ball.
Yeah, I think it was like Matt Femright who had a bunch of data on this years ago of like who are actually the best jump ball winners. I think Valanciunas was like really up there. There's rampant tip stealing, by the way. Like I got a lot of problems with you people on the jump ball of just the terrible tosses, the amount of tip stealing.
Okay, so can we talk about this? That NBA officials can't throw a jump ball straight?
Like I've been an official just at like, you know, intramural at my high school, like I was able to throw the ball straight up in the air. Like it's not that hard to do.
Yeah, yeah. Like I don't know. Like I don't know what it is that Ken Maurer's doing with that little the toss from his waist thing that he does, and then
I think like his hair gel is just like pulling his head back so far that he just like can't actually determine like what's straight up and down.
And then Kevin Cutler is gonna elbow both players in the head. You ever see him? What he does.
He holds
the ball up. You've seen Kevin Cutler. He's huge. He's 6'8". Yeah. He's holding the ball up over his head with like almost like he's shooting a free throw and pops it up like that. There's some interesting stylistic variations in how these guys do it, but there's not a lot of them where you think, wow, that ball went straight up right between the two of them. There's definitely some toss quality issues. I think they should practice that a little more.
Oh, yeah. This will tease the future episode, but you and Seth talked about it in your piece on The Athletic this week. But I would love to have more of a substantial conversation with you about officiating and like how you guys dealt with your issues with the official. But that'll you have to subscribe to get that. We're gonna that'll be a future episode. All right, you ready for a little Holland Journeys here?
Yeah, sure.
All right, so this early in the season, and we're about 2.5 weeks in now. You have drafted this player. Front office really thinks he's ready. Wants him to play. You know, Michael Porter Jr., we groomed him all last year. He's ready to go. He's fully healthy. Mike Malone's not playing him. You talked about playing faster all off season. You come in, 6 games in, 25th in the league in pace. How do you have that conversation with your coach about, hey, you know what? Like, why are you doing it this way? This was kind of the plan going in. Just take me through what those conversations are like, because obviously, you know, I think every front office in the league is going to have those with the coach at some point, because you're not going to be in absolute lockstep just naturally.
Yeah, and I think it's important that it's a flow and a back and forth, and not just a single point where there's one meeting where you discuss this. The best front office coach combos have a constant stream of communication and back and forth, so that even after the first couple games, you can kind of say, hey, look, I'm going to get Porter in there. I know. I mean, Mike Malone was literally telling me 24 hours ago how much he needs to play Michael Porter and get him in there because he's so talented and it can't be a wasted year. So at some level, he believes in this too.
Why don't they just send him down to the G League, get some reps?
You know, I mean, that the G League is going to start well, another week.
If they
had a
G League team. Sorry, that was my little Denver dig there.
Well, you know what, though? They've never been shy about assigning their guys to other G League teams. And they have, by this point, they've developed three or four they have a pretty good partnership with. I mean, obviously, they seem pretty fond of Washington's in particular. They sent multiple guys there last year. So I don't think any of that is out of the – and I'm not just talking about Michael Porter. I'm talking about with younger players in general. That was one of the things we did in Memphis. Now, granted, it was easier for us because our team was right there. But you assign – if a guy's not getting minutes on the NBA team, you assign him and get him minutes with the G League team. And the thing the mantra that I always tried to keep in my mind with the coaches was this idea of use it or lose it, that – If there's this young guy and we have him on your roster day to day and he's not playing, then we're going to take him and get him to the G League to get those minutes. But if he's actually going to play, then yes, we want him in the NBA game. That is definitely preferable.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I interrupted you. We went on that tangent. So you, whatever it is, pace, system, not taking shots from efficient areas, not playing a certain guy. There's a disconnect with the coach. How are you going to communicate that to him in a way that's not going to make him feel like, oh man, like, you know, you're really attacking me here?
Yeah. And ideally, it may not be a disconnect at all. Maybe it's the coach is coming to you and saying, look, I know we wanted to do X, Y, and Z. I'm trying to accomplish X, Y, and Z. Right now, I can't do X, Y, and Z because of these other issues, A, B, and C, you know. I'd like to run, but my center is 300 pounds, or I'd like to, you know, for example, hypothetically, I don't know what team we'd be talking about, but, you know, or I'd like to play this player, but our entire team is healthy right now and it's hard. So you just have a, but if you have a back and forth about those issues, it's a lot easier than saying, okay, we're dragging you into the conference room now and we're going to talk about this like that. That is by its nature hostile, and that it's like any business, right? I mean, it's ultimately the people and how you deal with them that determine a lot about what your outcomes are going to be.
I would imagine from the outside that simply having a dialogue with the coach every day, even when you don't have some kind of an issue and you just want to say, all right, this is going really well. Let's take stock here. You know, what do you think is going on? Is really important, so that it's not like, oh man, weekly meeting, like, how am I fucking up this week?
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like, oh, actually, no, we talk about stuff all the time. So now this is one of 20 messages that you're getting per week, or, you know, one of 20 conversations that you're having. So if you want to say something that, hey, you know, I don't agree with what you're doing here, it falls a little better when you just had a constant dialogue. But
exactly. Yeah. And then as a front office, you still have to be firm, I guess, in the sense that you're saying, okay, we understand that there are issues that are preventing this from happening in the present, but our overarching goal for this season is for this to happen. And at some point it needs to happen, you know, so that back and forth is happening, that there's an understanding, that there's the idea. Nobody should be shocked by anything that happens as a result, I guess, is the ideal.
It's got to be so tough, though, with coaches and front offices, because they obviously have different goals. And I would imagine one of the things that's really important is to try to align your evaluation of the coach of, hey, here's what your goals are for this year. It's not just let's win as many games as we can and get to 37 wins instead of 33. If, you know, that's where your team happens to be, you know, you're going to be judged on how well do these young players develop. But I think a lot of times coaches, you know, and maybe this even is true in the past, feel like, hey, you know what, you might be lying to me about that, or, you know, the outside world, if I'm like, maybe I'm going to get fired here anyway, and the outside world doesn't care if I develop this guy a little bit more to be on your team when I'm not there, like my record is what my record is. Communicating that and making the coach behave in a way that's in line with the organizational priorities rather than looking out for himself has got to be kind of hard.
Well, yeah. And the elephant in the room is the average life expectancy of a coach.
Yeah.
In a particular job, because the turnover rate historically has been so high, and they're aware of this, and they'd be foolish not to be aware of this, that influences behavior. It has to. And even any statement of commitment from management or ownership, I think, is treated with a little bit of suspicion that, okay, well, if we lose six in a row, then how do you feel? And it's totally rational on their part, right? Like that's the environment the league has operated in. I mean, we saw it in Memphis. So that I think is a thing that infects the coach GM relationship, because in the front office, like, our heads are in next year already. By this time, we're already looking at free agents and draft and what's coming ahead. Our work for this year, it's not quite done, but you know, we have in our head, we built the roster for this year. There'll be trades and call ups and whatnot, but your head a lot of times is looking at cap sheets in 2020 and 21 and figuring out where we're going toward next. Whereas the coach's mindset is absolutely in the here and now and present, where they're not looking at anything beyond next week or Thanksgiving at best, right? And so those competing mindsets, I think, get in the way of a productive relationship. And the best partnerships achieve a level of stability or security that can go past that. I mean, Malone's been there long enough now with Tim Connelly that I think they can have a little more productive interaction probably because of that.
So who are some coach and team relationships that stand out to you as being somewhat positive, or somewhat, I shouldn't say somewhat, like really positive in that area where you're like, okay, this coach, especially for teams, you know, that may have been more on the rebuilding scale, at least initially, this coach is really in lockstep with the front office. Like, they are clearly on the same page.
Well, obviously, Pop and RC is the first one you think of, yeah, right? Sure. That's the gold standard. Then you go through, I would say, Neil Olshey and Terry Stotts, they've been together a long time. I think they get what each other's about and understand, even if...
It helps when they have the same agent, too.
Well, it does, but even so, I mean, and you've seen actually where there were points in the beginning where they maybe would have had a little more friction about some stuff that I think they don't as much anymore. They kind of get each other at this point. I think you see Steve Kerr and Bob Myers.
I think there might be a little bit more this year, just from from being around the team. But now I think they're all on the same page. But I think, you know, this year, the organization kind of punting on this year and getting hard capped. And, like, you know, I think Kerr might have felt the expectations were a little bit too high. We saw him even publicly kind of tamping those down. But now I think they're all be on the same page again, because they're not going to win regardless of what they do. But that was one where I felt like they were in lockstep, and then they may have brought some friction because of the moves this summer.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, that's another part of it. Like, you could, the one I left out is Riley and Andy Ellisberg and Eric Spoelstra in Miami.
Oh, yeah, that one is just, they really seem on the same page. I think of some of the newer tenure coaches, I think Atlanta and Brooklyn, I think, like, they have really been on the same page as far as development. It's okay to take your lumps, and, you know, Atlanta with Lloyd Pierce and Travis Schlenk, and they've done a pretty good job of developing players in those two destinations. Now we'll see, you know, in Brooklyn, now that the expectations will be a little higher, how well that lasts. But I think to get to the point that those two teams have, I think it's all, like, when you look at the amount of minutes that players play on those teams as well, that really shows me that, you know, in Brooklyn, they basically never played anyone over 30 minutes until this year,
yeah,
for example. And so, yeah, like, that really shows me that you're in lockstep a lot there.
We left out Brad Stevens and Danny Ainge too. I think that's been a good partnership. You don't quite see it as it doesn't manifest in maybe as obvious a way as it does in a situation like Atlanta, where, you know, Cam Reddish and DeAndre Hunter are starting every game. But I think it's there.
So we talked about kind of, okay, the idea of, hey, the organization's long-term plans versus winning right now. But what if you're in a win now mode, but the coach isn't doing the things that you think are the best to actually win games right now?
That's a hard conversation to have, because you're basically, you're basically saying you wish someone else was coaching the team. Right? Like, you know, it depends on how big a strategic piece you're talking about too. There are levels to this, obviously, but it starts with a communication, you know, here's what we're doing well, here's what we're doing badly in the eyes of management, and agreeing on facts, first of all. Is this guy good or does he suck? Like, you'd be amazed how many times there's disagreement on that, right?
Sure.
And so start there, and then get to kind of strategy and tactics.
Do you think there's a certain type of player where coaches are more likely to favor him, whereas front offices are more likely to favor a different type of player, just in your observation around the league as well as your personal experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The 30-year-old veteran who doesn't really have a lot of pop, maybe, and, you know, is just kind of an okay shooter, but I don't know. You know the type of guy I'm talking, like the Lance Thomas type.
Yeah. Yeah, coaches kind of, just by their nature, they're about correcting mistakes. And so they value so much the absence of mistakes, I think, and perhaps overvalue it when, you know, maybe this guy isn't actually doing anything out there either, even if he's not screwing up.
Yeah, I would say that my experience would back that up.
So, or if you're just like, hey, you know, we're not shooting enough threes, or hey, you know what, like, we kind of need the transition defense to be better or something like that. I mean, is that just, do you ultimately just have to, like, take a step back and be like, all right, you know, if he's not going to do this, we're going to fire him? Or is it like, well, you know, no, I want to actually, like, make these issues known and say, hey, this is what you have to address. Because, I mean, you're saying, hey, you want someone else to coach the team, but, you know, there is a management aspect to it.
Yeah.
I understand how ridiculous it is, right? Of like, hey, you're evaluating the coach, but you're not actually a coach. This person probably knows more about coaching than you, but yet you're trying to evaluate him at the same time.
You know, sometimes sometimes you realize in the back and forth there are good reasons for things that are happening, where you say, hey, we need to work on this, and you know, we're really bad at this, and the coach will come back with, well, we have limited practice time and we need to focus on this other thing that we're even worse at. or that there might be a situation that has nothing to do with basketball, let's say, that is causing certain minutes to be happening the way they are. just based on interpersonal dynamics in the locker room or other things that are going on, or other players that haven't earned their stripes in some way. So there are always elements of that. And it's amazing how many different levels you're asking the coach to deal with in terms of being the CEO of his staff and his assistants, in terms of managing the player development and players getting better, in terms of managing the game, drawing plays out of timeouts, delineating roles for offense and defense, dealing with officials, and then obviously creating the overarching strategy of the team and how it's structured and how it's going to play. I mean, we ask a lot of them, and there are very few people who are a 10 out of 10 on every single one of these axes.
Yeah.
And that's usually where some of the tension comes in, is that you realize that this guy is really good at this, but maybe not so good at this. And then you need to have a discussion about how do we get you to be better at this? Or if you're never going to be better at this, is that acceptable?
Yeah. Well, we promise that we are going to continue to get better at this each and every week. You want to get us out of here, John?
Yeah, sure. Thanks everyone for listening once again. This is John Hollinger from The Athletic and Nate Duncan, and we'll be back at it next week and every week, and we hope you find us on Apple and iTunes and wherever else you can find podcasts, and subscribe.
All right. John promises that he will do that better next week. No, that's you're improving, man. You're going to be a pro by the end of the year.
Become a podcast veteran next week, my delivery will be so much smoother.
Yeah, we only got 50 more of these episodes this season to get through. All right, well, thanks, man. This is fun, and we will talk to you all next week. Till then.